Tonight I want us to look at Jesus' healing of the demon-possessed man recounted to us in Luke's Gospel in chapter 8, which we read earlier. Now, there's one thing we need to be perfectly clear about right at the outset, and it's this, that the events recounted in Luke 8, which we've just read, really happened. We need to be clear on this because it's not fashionable to believe in evil spirits in the society in which we live. So we need to reiterate that we've just read and what's recorded in Luke 8 is an historical account based on eyewitness testimony. Now, Luke placed high premium on eyewitness testimony. He knew that it was vital for establishing truth in order so that his readers could be certain about what they believed. We get that from the very beginning of his gospel. He tells us that those who proclaimed the gospel in the early church from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word. That's Luke chapter 1, verse 2. He's saying what qualified them, the apostles, to be ministers of the word, ministers of the gospel, was that they were eyewitnesses from the very beginning of Jesus' ministry. And he goes on to explain what qualifies him to write his gospel account is because, verse 3, chapter 1, he followed all the things closely and is able to write an orderly account. Why? Why is he writing? Because, he says, you may have certainty of these things. So we can be certain that what we've just read is real history. With that said, let's have a look at this text. And please have it open in front of you if you have the Bible. And we're going to look at this account under three headings. So 3 points. First point, point number one, a miserable existence. Now, it's hard to imagine a more miserable life than the life of the man we read about in Luke 8. Jesus and his disciples had just sailed over the Sea of Galilee and landed in a region east of Palestine. As they stepped on the land that is Greek, it's a Greek region, they're immediately confronted by a man who had an unclean spirit. Look with me at Luke chapter 6, rather chapter 8, verse 26. Then they, as Jesus and his disciples, sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. When Jesus had stepped out on land, there met him a man from the city who had demons. For a long time, he had worn no clothes, and he had not lived in a house, but among the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. It's a disturbing scene. It's not just indecent, it's frightening. Jesus and his disciples are confronted by a man who comes at them with no clothes on. We're told that he was cut off from the community in which he lived. Verse 27 of that chapter, it says, he had not lived in a house, but among the tombs. So he didn't live in a house with people. He didn't even live by himself. He lived among the tombs, among the dead. He was alone. But more than that, he lived among the dead. He was a walking dead. There's something dark and dehumanizing about the man. We're told also that he was under the control of an evil spirit. Look with me again at verse 28 to 29. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many a time it had seized him. He was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles, but he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. Did you notice? The spirit that was in him many a time had seized him. It took hold of him and at times drove him into the desert. He was a prisoner. He was under the control of something else. Now, we're told in verse 29, the spirit that was in him was unclean, which means it was evil. We're also told that it was intelligent. It spoke. It was parasitic. It used the man as a host, as a vehicle. And it was a ruling spirit over other spirits under it. You see it in verse 30. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. So there was an entire team of evil spirits in this man. It's frightening. Here was a man who lived alone. He was an outcast of society, scurrying among the hills, among the tombs, naked. And there was no way out for him. Some of the villagers tried to help him in a crude way. They put him in chains and shackles and kept him under guard. But he broke the chains and fled. For many a time it had seized him. He was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles. But he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. The evil in him overpowered him and those who tried to help him. Couldn't anyone help him? Anyone? No. He was helpless and hopeless, only to be pitied by others for his miserable existence. So what's this incident got to do with you and me? What's it got to do with us living in the 21st century? Well, the message is clear and unmistakable. As you read the Bible from Genesis to Revelation, you'll find that the description of the condition of this man is a picture of the condition of the human race. It's a picture of you and me. It's a picture of us. Awareness of one's nakedness in Bible language points to awareness of sin, to a sense of guilt and shame before God. Let's go back to Eden. Let's go back to the beginning, to the time and place in history when mankind walked with God and delighted in him. But everything changed in that garden. When Adam and Eve sinned against God, they felt shame. The turning point is recorded in Genesis chapter 3. Let's pick it up from verse 6. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband, who was with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths or coverings. At the beginning, Adam and Eve had perfect communion with God. They were naked before God, but being sinless, they had nothing to be ashamed of. But did you notice? After they had sinned, they knew that they were naked. There was a new sense of self-awareness. It wasn't that they weren't self-aware before, they were. The awareness of their nakedness now stemmed from a sense of guilt. They knew that they had sinned and were guilty before God. Their sinful hearts were exposed and naked before God. That's why they tried to cover themselves, to cover their shame and hide from God. And you and me, the children of Adam, are naked before God. And feeling our shame, we've been trying to cover ourselves and run away from God ever since. We wear clothes, not just over our bodies, but over our shame, over a guilty conscience. We come up with excuses to push God away because we know we've wronged him. We want to cover our guilty consciences, and so we suppress the truth and the testimony of our conscience. Now, Charles Darwin was considered a gentleman of Victorian society. He was educated, sophisticated, and polished with Victorian sensibilities. When Darwin stumbled upon the inhabitants of Tierra del Fuego, at the lower tip of South America, he saw that the native people lived naked. He was shocked by the scene of naked people who greeted him. He wrote in his journal, the astonishment which I felt on first seeing a party of Phrygians on a wild and broken shore will never be forgotten by me. For the reflection at once rushed into my mind. Such were our ancestors. These men were absolutely naked and bedaubed with paint. Their long hair was tangled, their mouths frothed with excitement, and their expression was wild, startled, and distrustful. And then he wrote this, he who has seen a savage in his native land will not feel much shame if forced to acknowledge that the blood of some humble creature flows in his veins. Confronted with a community of people who shamelessly lived naked, Darwin took them for animals. And he told himself that he mustn't feel ashamed for saying that, for saying that they have the blood of gorillas and chimpanzees coursing through their veins. But he felt the shame of what he was saying, even as he was trying to justify himself. Ironically, he was wearing clothes, and they were the ones who were naked. But he felt the shame of the knowledge of God, the knowledge that God is his creator, that he'd wronged God. And he tried to cover his shame with silly ideas, anything, anything to get rid of God. We cover our shame and we run away from God. What excuses do you have to push God away? What are the clothes you wear to cover your guilty conscience? My friend, it doesn't have to be this way. God himself can provide a covering. He can deal with your sin and remove your shame. And he does it legally before the court of heaven, the highest court there is, because someone else has paid the price so that guilty sinners can be forgiven. And his name is Jesus. You really can have your shame removed. And so moving on to our second point, a transformed life. Now the turning point in this man's life was his encounter with Jesus. Jesus Christ set him free. Look at the climactic encounter in verse 28. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." The unclean spirit recognized Jesus. Here was the Son of God. Here was the King. And the evil spirit knew it. Now the evil spirit initially took Jesus' appearance to mean that the day of judgment had come, or come early. It anticipated torment. Verse 28, "I beg you, do not torment me." Well, that was not to be. That will be on the final day of judgment. We'll read about that in Revelation 20, verse 10. The devil who had deceived them, that's the world, was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur where the beast and the false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. The day of judgment will be the day of torment for all of God's enemies. That was to come later. With that not being the case, the evil spirit then pleaded not to be cast into the abyss, the bottomless pit. And that bottomless pit is alluded to in Revelation. I'm going to read again another text from Revelation. And it's a place of temporary confinement for evil spirits. It's the place of the binding of Satan during the period of the proclamation of the gospel, the age in which we live. So Revelation chapter 20, verse 1. "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pits and a great chain. And he seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and threw him into the pit, and shut it and sealed it over him, so that he might not deceive the nations any longer, until the 1,000 years were ended, After that, he must be released for a little while. This binding of Satan is something that Jesus does. Jesus, as the true king, has the power to bind Satan and then to raid his empire and to set people free, to set his prisoners free. It's a demonstration of divine power. It's a demonstration that the kingdom of God is advancing on earth. And that is what happens. Verse 29. He had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. And then verse 31, and they begged him not to command them to depart into the abyss. That's the bottomless pit. Now, a large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him to let them enter these. So he gave them permission. Then the demons came out of the man and entered the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and drowned. It's dramatic stuff. Jesus, by his word, overpowered a legion of evil spirits and set the man free. And Jesus restored his humanity. Look with me at what happened next, verse 34. When the herdsmen saw what had happened, they fled and told it in the city and in the country. Then people went out to see what had happened. And they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone, sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. Don't you love these words? He was clothed and in his right mind. His sanity was restored. He was restored to community life, to being close to people again, to feel the warmth of human relationships. Because Jesus changed his heart. You can see he loved Jesus and wanted to be with him. You see it in verse 35, sitting at Jesus' feet. Sitting at Jesus' feet, what does that mean? It means listening to Jesus, listening to Jesus' teaching, Jesus' word. He longed for the company of Jesus. Verse 38, the man from whom the demons had gone begged that he might be with him. But Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you." And he went away, proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Jesus had done for him. A transformed life. Now, when Christians speak of an encounter with Jesus Christ, it's because he really has changed them. Ask them, and they'll tell you what God has done for them. They'll tell you how Jesus set them free from their sin, how he restored them to a relationship with himself, and how much they love Jesus and his word, and how they want to know him better and follow him all the days of their lives. Because they were living in their sin, in their shame, separated from God. But Jesus met with them and saved them. And Jesus Christ can save you, because he came to save sinners by taking their punishment upon himself. Now, we talked earlier about Charles Darwin. Well, there was a contemporary of Darwin, a man by the name of David Livingstone, who too was a gentleman of the Victorian age. But he wasn't shaped by Victorian thinking. He knew the God of the Bible. He'd met with Jesus, and he knew the reality of a new heart. So when he met with indigenous Africans on his travels, he didn't take them for gorillas and chimpanzees. He saw them as people, as the children of Adam, human beings made in the image of God, but broken by sin and cut off from God. He saw them as sinners living in darkness, because he knew his own sin. He knew his own darkness. He knew his own nakedness before God and what Jesus Christ had done for him. So he preached Jesus to them. In fact, David Livingstone gave 30 years of his life to reaching the natives of Africa with the gospel. And eventually, he died in Africa doing so. Here was a Christ-shaped man. And in him, you can hear the echo of the gospel. A life given to rescue others, just like a savior. Because the sinless, perfect Son of God came into this world and he died. He died. He died naked. He died a shameful, humiliating death. He took the place of sinners. So he took their guilt and their shame. He died as an outcast, rejected by his own people and rejected by God. As he hung on the cross, he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" But there was silence from heaven because he was forsaken. He died in the place of sinners. But he didn't stay dead. Jesus Christ rose from the dead, overcoming death and the power of darkness, which is why there's power, legal power. My guilt really is dealt with. There's transforming power. I'm given a new heart. Divine power. An encounter with Jesus that transforms sinners. And he can set you free. Will you trust in him? And will you receive him? Our final point, a hostile response. Now, if the transformation of the demon-possessed man was anything to go by, you'd have thought that Jesus would be received by the people in that region, that he would be invited to stay with them, that the healing of the man would be a day of joy and celebration for the entire region. But that wasn't the case. When the people heard what had happened, they were frightened and wanted Jesus to go away. Verse 34. When the herdsmen saw what had happened, they fled and told it in the city and in the country. Then people went out to see what had happened, and they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone, sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it told them how the demon-possessed man had been healed. Then all the people of the surrounding country of the Gerasenes asked him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear. So he got into the boats and returned. Jesus had transformed the life of this man, a man who was known to everyone in that region as a hopeless man, a hopeless case. No one could help him. No one could control him. The miracle of his transformation was clear for all to see. They knew him. They all knew him. So why, knowing that Jesus had healed him, knowing what Jesus had done for him, why did they want Jesus to go away? Were they frightened? Was that it? They wanted Jesus to go away because it was a frightening experience. So maybe they wanted to forget the whole experience. It was all a frightening experience. So if Jesus goes away, they can forget what had happened and go back to normal life. Was that it? Well, the key to unlock what drove the townsfolk is the behavior of the evil spirit that drove the man who was healed. Look with me at how the evil spirit responded to Jesus in verse 28. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." The evil spirit recognized Jesus and was frightened, was terrified. At first, prematurely anticipated torment, "Do not torment me." And then feared being thrown into the abyss. Verse 31. They begged him not to command them to depart into the abyss, so which is a place of restraint, a place of containment. Do you see? The evil spirit's response was hostile. It wanted nothing to do with Jesus. It dreaded judgment. It feared restraint. It was conscious, deliberate hostility to God. Now, do you see what's controlling the townsfolk? Why were they hostile to Jesus? Why didn't they receive Jesus who had healed this poor man? Why do they want Jesus to go away? Why did an occasion for rejoicing, a divine intervention in this man's life, leave them frightened and wanting Jesus to go away? Because they were sinners living in darkness and under the dominion of another power. They feared judgment because they were guilty. They hated the light because they lived in darkness. Now, what was the better power? The power of Jesus or the power of darkness? The power that loved them or the power that oppressed them? The power that came to rescue or the power that abuses and destroys? My friend, when you resist the gospel, you're getting a raw deal. You're not free. In my sin, I'm not free. Left to ourselves, we're under the control of a principle, a tendency, a nature that is evil, that is opposed to God. And even when we realize we're destroying ourselves, we can't stop ourselves because we're not in control. We're under the dominion of a power that has control over us. The tendency for evil in us is a dominant part of our nature. And you know that's true because you too have your demons. They control you. You have a restless, empty soul. And as you give yourself to that which promises satisfaction, it doesn't work. But you keep going, and you keep going, and you keep going, giving yourself and giving yourself. And you can't help it. You can't control it. It controls you. What addictions do you have? They enslave you. Maybe others have tried to help you. Maybe they've seen the danger you're in, and they've tried to shackle you to try and contain the damage that you do to yourself. But they can't stop you, and you can't stop yourself. Even as you destroy yourself and your relationships, the people that love you, you can't stop yourself. Maybe people have written you off. They see you as a hopeless case. Hopeless and helpless. My friend, the good news is Jesus will have you. He came to rescue sinners, prisoners. He's good. He's the King who comes to save, who lays down his life. The power in him is good. It's the better power. He comes to save you, not to destroy you. He comes with a heart of love and a power to save. My friend, will you receive him? Will you come to him and trust in him and tell him all your heart, all your sin, all your confusion, all your anxieties, and ask him to give you a new heart?